next met with Dr. George Blumenschein from MD Anderson Cancer Center, and to begin, we discussed the patient from his practice.
So this is actually a gentleman who presented at another institution before I saw him, originally in 2011, and at that time he underwent a resection. He had an epithelioid mesothelioma, and there are three variants. There's epithelioid mixed, which is a combination of sarcomatoid and epithelioid, and then sarcomatoid. And epithelioid's the best actor of the group and tends to be more sensitive to chemotherapy. And when you're considering an intervention such as a decortication or an extrapleural pneumonectomy, if you have an epithelioid tumor, that's an indication to consider that if the patient meets the other staging criteria. But if they have sarcomatoid, either as part of the mixed histology or sarcomatoid at all, then you don't proceed to surgery.
You mentioned the question of decortication. What are the types of surgical procedures that are done, and how do you decide whether or not to embark on these?
So there are several variations on a theme. There's an extrapleural pneumonectomy, which is the most aggressive, which is essentially a pneumonectomy as well as a removal of the pleura. And then there's decortication, which is not as involved as an extrapleural pneumonectomy. I think what drives this is the patient has to meet the staging criteria, have operable disease, and have a functional status which will allow him to proceed with surgery and have a meaningful quality of life after surgery. In addition to which, I think it comes down to a skill set. Some physicians are more adept with extrapleural pneumonectomy than others. I think the tertiary centers have a lot of experience with this. And this is an area which is an evolution about what the best approach is surgically. For this particular patient, when he first presented in 2011, he underwent decortication and then he underwent talc pleuridesis. And unfortunately, he recurred. And at that point, he was treated with pemetrexed and carboplatin, which he completed in June of 2012. And this was then followed by a redo thoracotomy and decortication with a little more extensive resection of his diaphragm and reconstruction in April of 2012. Did well. And then in 2015, he developed recurrent disease. And then he came to MD Anderson, where I saw him for the first time. He wasn't a surgical candidate at that point, and we knew he had responded to his pemetrexed carboplatin several years prior. So we proceeded to treat him with pemetrexed and cisplatin, with or without the addition of cedarinib, which is an oral VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor, as part of a clinical trial that we're running. So he completed six cycles of the combination chemotherapy and had a response and continued on with the pill, which is either placebo or cedarinib, and is now in the maintenance phase of this, where he's taking the placebo / cedarinib and following up about every 2 months.
How is he doing in terms of side effects and tolerability? Do you think he's on the placebo, or it's kind of hard to tell?
It's kind of hard to tell. He actually tolerated his chemotherapy quite well and got all six cycles in, as I mentioned, responded, didn't develop neuropathy, didn't develop tinnitus, and continued to work. He's now taking the cedarinib and is tolerating things well.
And cedarinib, as you mentioned, is an anti-angiogenic. Do you see hypertension and other angiogenic?
Right. So some of the things you would see with this is a class effect, hypertension, certainly. You monitor that, you look for proteinuria. And actually, while he was on therapy, he did develop a pulmonary embolus and was placed on Lovenox.
That's interesting. You know, it's interesting that he got on this trial of cedarinib. We have seen some data, I think last year's ASCO, for example, looking at bevacizumab in mesothelioma, you know, also obviously an anti-angiogenic. Where do we stand with that? And is that a strategy that you think would be reasonable to utilize outside a trial setting in mesothelioma?
So you're referencing the trial, I think, that came out of Europe, which was pemetrexed cisplatin with or without the addition of bevacizumab. And actually, that study was a positive trial. I think the median overall survival was approximately a year and a half. And the other interesting part is that the standard of care arm, which is pemetrexed cisplatin, did better than we traditionally seen, also exceeding the one-year median survival we traditionally seen with that combination. But yes, to get to your point, I do think that's a potential therapeutic option for patients who are otherwise good candidates for bevacizumab. They don't have a bleeding diathesis, kidney function's good, blood pressure's controlled. It doesn't look like there's something near a blood vessel which would be worrisome for potential bleed.
So I was curious in terms of what's new in mesothelioma. We've worked with your colleague Ann Sal, and she's updated us on some things. But I see that at ASCO, you presented an interesting phase one study on anti-mesothelin antibody drug conjugate, anitumab rabtansine. Of course, we've seen antibody drug conjugates in breast cancer, TDM1, lymphoma, brentuximab vedotin. What about this agent?
Well, so this is an interesting compound, and as you mentioned, it's an ADC, so it targets mesothelin, which is obviously very highly expressed, on the order of about 100% in mesothelioma, and minimally so in normal tissue. And you look for that in an ADC. You don't want to have off-site toxicity. And what the ADC does is it has a payload, and the compound mates with the receptor and is internalized into the cancer cell, and the payload is delivered. And this was a phase one trial. And we saw activity in both peritoneal and pleural mesothelioma with responses in patients who were heavily pretreated. And in patients who had had one prior line of treatment, the response rates were over 40%. So it was very robust response in this large phase one. And this has now led to an ongoing phase two effort, which is currently accruing patients and plans to move into the frontline setting and even to other tumor types which have overexpression of mesothelin.
Have you had patients yourself receive this agent who had what you thought were clinically useful responses?
Yes. So I actually have a patient who has peritoneal mesothelioma who has been on this therapy for greater than a year and tolerating treatment well and having good quality of life. So yes, I've seen patients who have benefited from this.
Now, this patient, though, was there an objective response?
Yes. Objective response.
Interesting. And what kinds of toxicity issues, you know, with bevacizumab, we saw peripheral neuropathy, TDM1, a couple other things, LFTs, platelets. What do you see, if anything, with this agent?
Well, so you see some neuropathy, and we noted in patients who had multiple lines of therapy, including several lines of taxanes, that there was an increase in peripheral neuropathy. But the real rate limiter on this was actually corneal epithelialization. Essentially, you epithelialize your cornea. So we had to work around that, and what it essentially involved was early identification, close monitoring with an ophthalmologist, and dose adjustments and or dose holds. And this is something that's self-contained and resolves.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I remember hearing about an antibody drug conjugate. I think it was an ovarian cancer that also caused ophthalmologic. Sounds kind of like what you just described.
Yes, actually, it's been seen in a number of drugs in this class, and it's likely due to the payload utilized. So it's a class effect, and various management strategies are being developed around that.
So you also at ASCO had the trial in progress poster about the phase two study that you were describing that came out of this. Really sounds kind of exciting, actually, particularly for mesothelioma. What about the phase two trial? How long do you think it's going to take to see some results from that?
Well, the study is actually accruing quite well, and this is a randomized study of the ADC versus vinorelbine. And this study is actually accruing ahead of schedule. So it's open currently. It's exceeding its time points in terms of patient accrual. There's a lot of enthusiasm for it. And so I think we should have results from this within, I would think, the next year to year and a half.
From your point of view, what's the primary endpoint and what's sort of the thinking in terms of the potential of bringing this into practice?
Well, I think for the study, we're looking at, you know, things such as response, progression-free survival. I think the scope of this is, if we take a step back, is that mesothelioma, currently there's one approved approach, and that's utilization of pemetrexed with a platinum agent in the frontline setting. There is no approved second-line option for patients. Oftentimes, we use other cytotoxics, such as gemcitabine, but there really is no second-line option. And as we saw from this past ASCO, there have been some clinical trials exploring the utilization of immunotherapy. For example, there was a study with CTLA-4 versus placebo, which was a randomized phase three trial, which was actually a negative study. We'll talk a little bit later about the PD-L1 trial that was also reported on in mesothelioma. But right now, it's an underserved population. It's a population at need. And so I think this will provide, if it's a positive outcome, a new option for patients.
Yeah, I think particularly the fact that it's non-toxic makes it particularly attractive. In terms of, you mentioned immunotherapy, particularly checkpoint inhibitors and that anti-CTLA-4 study, I think it was tremelimumab.
Yes.
But there's also a paper presented on an anti-PD-L1 agent, avelumab. It's not currently approved. What was reported there at ASCO? And also, what do we know right now in general about anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 agents in mesothelioma?
So we know that PD-L1 is expressed in mesothelioma, and that was part of the rationale for enrolling patients on this trial. It was about a 50-54 patient study, single arm, and patients received avelumab, which is a monoclonal antibody, IgG1 targeting PD-L1, which is on the surface of the tumor. Patients were enrolled independent of their PD-L1 status, and what they were looking for was indication of activity measured by response, progression-free survival, and then also expression of PD-L1 to see if they could correlate that with outcomes. They did see a response. Response rate was about 9.4%. And then the interesting thing was when they looked at outcomes by PD-L1 status, and they had tissue of the 50-odd patients, they had tissue in about 39 that they could utilize to evaluate PD-L1 status. Two of the patients who responded were PD-L1 positive, and two of the patients who responded were PD-L1 negative. So a little bit clouding of the picture there. But again, it may come down to the fact that the testing with PD-L1 is not an exact science. What they reported from that trial in particular was a PFS benefit of about 17 weeks versus 7 weeks for patients who were PD-L1 positive. But then when you look at it at about 24 weeks, when they took a look back at the progression-free survival, they were equivalent. They were 39 and 40 weeks respectively. So that didn't correlate over the long haul. I think what this study represented was just an opportunity to demonstrate activity, and they're going to be building upon this, looking at combinations with CTLA-4, which can upregulate PD-L1 and potentially turn a, quote, cold tumor into a hot one that might benefit from PD-L1 therapy. Plus, there'll be combinations with chemotherapy and also with vaccines, potentially with anti-mesothelin ADCs as well. But to get to your point, the duration of response, those patients who respond, especially in the non-small cell lung cancer space, have very durable responses. In the phase 3 studies that were reported out with nivolumab in the second line setting, duration of response was on the order of 18 months or 17 months, quite long. So when these responses occur, they are durable.
But can we say anything about duration of response with mesothelioma at this point?
You know, that was a small trial. It was one of the largest studies done with immunotherapy, aside from the tremelimumab trial, but it was only 50-odd patients. And I don't think we have enough data to really comment on that. There were 5 responses, so I think we need more time.
But I also wanted to get an update on another antibody drug conjugate that I started hearing about, I think it was about a year ago, and Charlie Rudin, again at ASCO, presented some data. This is in small cell. And it's rovalpituzumab tesirine, a delta-like protein-targeted antibody-drug conjugate. What's your take overall on that drug?
Oh, I think this drug looked very promising. This was a phase 1 first-in-human study, but they enrolled approximately 70 patients with small cell lung cancer. And the reason to go after DLL3 in this particular patient population is it's expressed on small cell cancer cells roughly 80% or more. You'll see DLL3. And what this does is inhibits Notch. So this is, again, an ADC where you have the antibody and then you have a payload, which causes DNA strand breaks. And they saw activity in these patients, both in the second line setting and in the third line setting. In fact, in the third line setting, response rates were 50% in small cell lung cancer, which is amazing. Again, small number of patients, but very robust responses. They saw an overall response rate of about 40%. I think it was 39 or 40%. In patients who expressed greater than 50% DLL3, which turns out to be about 2/3 of patients with small cell lung cancer. So it's an identifiable biomarker to select therapy, akin to what we're using now with EGFR mutations and EGFR inhibitors.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
And again, from what you can tell, are these responses clinically meaningful, reasonable duration?
Yes, the responses seem to be durable. The overall survival rate was better than you would expect with standard of care. And historically, looking back at topotecan, which is the one approved regimen in the refractory setting, more robust responses, more durable responses. So I think this is a drug that we're very excited about. And right now, there's an ongoing phase 2 study in third-line non-small cell lung cancer. And their plans, obviously, to bring this forward into the frontline setting and look at immunotherapy combinations as well. So I think this is an exciting compound.
I want to ask you about a few papers, mostly presented at ASCO, some of which you were involved with, some of which you weren't. One is a paper from Heather Wakely of the ECOG trial, more data from the adjuvant trial looking at chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. Of course, the bevacizumab part of that sort of flopped out like it has in breast and colon. But she presented some interesting data at ASCO looking at the kinds of adjuvant chemotherapy people received. And I wonder if you could comment on what she presented and kind of what you think it means.
And this was originally designed as a trial. It's a 1,500-patient study for patients who had resectable disease. And for this particular study, it was patients who had at least a 4-centimeter tumor up to stage 3 patients. If they were resected, they would be able to go on study, and they'd received adjuvant chemotherapy, a cisplatinum-based doublet, with or without the addition of bevacizumab. And as you mentioned, the bevacizumab, which was the primary endpoint, the addition of that to the standard combinations, was not a positive trial. It was a wash. So they went back and did a subset analysis on the various chemotherapies, and then they subsetted that by histology. So there was a squamous group, which got docetaxel, gemcitabine, vinorelbine with cisplatin. And then there was a non-squamous group, which got the aforementioned drugs plus pemetrexed. And the take-home message, again, was cisplatin-based doublet, it doesn't matter what it is, it works equally well. She went through the various toxicities, and some of the drugs had different toxicities in terms of rates of neuropathy or rates of thrombocytopenia, for example, with gemcitabine. But overall, there was no difference in overall survival or progression-free survival. And I think what this ultimately means for physicians practicing right now is when you have a patient who's had resected disease and is a candidate for adjuvant treatment, you take into account their comorbidities and what you think they're able to tolerate. For example, someone who has underlying peripheral neuropathy, you probably don't want to give a taxane or vinorelbine. You can give them gemcitabine if they have squamous cell with cis, if you can give cis, or you can give pemetrexed if they have a non-squamous tumor. I think those are the take-home messages from that. And what they also did to kind of minimize confounding issues with this was they centralized the dose of cisplatin at 75 milligrams per meter squared once every 3 weeks. So there weren't various doses of drugs being given. I think the take-home is cisplatin still required to get that survival benefit, and you can add the appropriate drug as part of the combination based on your practice experience and what the patient's comorbidities are.
So in your own practice, how do you approach selecting the partner for cisplatin for squamous and non-squamous in the adjuvant setting outside a trial setting?
So if I have a patient who meets the criteria that I just outlined, has the appropriately sized primary tumor or stage of disease, we'll discuss adjuvant chemotherapy and discuss that it has about a 5% overall survival benefit. And then if they don't have any underlying comorbidities, it's cisplatin 75 milligrams per meter squared, either with a taxane or with pemetrexed, depending on the histology. And I do this relatively routinely in my practice, unless someone has some underlying issues, or after we discuss the results, decides they just don't want to do chemotherapy, which sometimes happens.
I guess the one thing about that data set that she presented that was interesting was that we've seen, you know, just by surveying both investigators and general oncologists in practice, extensive movement towards the use of pemetrexed in non-squamous in the adjuvant setting. And there's always been the question of, is there enough solid data behind PEM compared to, for example, vinorelbine? And some people felt that these data that she presented sort of was more support for that.
And she brought that point up. And they did amend the trial, I think, in 2009 to add pemetrexed and cisplatin as an arm for the non-squamous group because of the data that came out with pemetrexed and cisplatin. And I think there's an ongoing study evaluating this in a prospective fashion to ascertain if there's a difference between that. But when you look back at the older studies from the early 2000s, late 90s, the one thing that stands out is the patients that benefited all got cisplatin. And in fact, vinorelbine cis did the best in those meta-analyses. They also got the highest dose of cisplatin. So I think cisplatin is a key player in this particular space, and then less so the chemotherapy you add on to it. Now, these other chemotherapies have less toxicity and might be a good pairing, such as pemetrexed.
So I'm going to go on and talk about another one of your cases, your 70-year-old man.
Okay. So this is actually a gentleman who came to us after receiving carboplatin paclitaxel. He was being treated in an outside facility, completed treatment in May of 2016. And then got his repeat imaging about 2 months later and presented with progression of disease. So we talked about the options. And as you know, nivolumab is approved for the treatment of refractory squamous cell and non-squamous cell, non-small cell lung cancer. So we reviewed this option with him. He didn't have any contraindications, i.e. had no autoimmune illnesses. And he began therapy with this. And he's actually tolerating it quite well, not having any side effects at all.
And how long has he been on treatment now?
He's been on treatment for approximately 2 months now. And so he's coming up on his first set of scans, but he remains asymptomatic. And he feels much better having been off chemotherapy. It'll be interesting to see if his scans are supportive of this. I'm hoping he's responding.
So I'm going to go back through a few things about this case and in squamous cell carcinoma in general. And the first is upfront therapy and first-line therapy of metastatic disease. We've seen, when we poll general oncologists, kind of a split between three kinds of doublets, either gemcitabine, paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel. How do you approach, again, selection of first-line therapy outside a trial setting? And again, there's also the issue of cisplatin versus carbo, but also the issue of necitumumab.
So in my practice, the majority of our patients come from outside of the city where I practice, and we usually do a Q3-week regimen, either with paclitaxel or docetaxel. Patients who have underlying neuropathy, I'll give gemcitabine with carboplatin. Those are my general approaches. I haven't used much in the way of nab-paclitaxel. I've made recommendations for that, and it's been used by the local oncologists if the patient lives at a distance.
We have heard people talking about NAB, particularly in squamous cell and in older patients where I guess some of the subset data suggested an advantage. Any thoughts about that?
No, I think the subset data looks interesting, and it is head-to-head probably a better tolerated drug. But the issue for us is that the schedule is a little more labor-intensive for the patients. So we end up doing mostly Q3-week therapies for that reason.
And then again, there is now an anti-EGFR antibody approved in non-small cell, necitumumab. Can you talk a little bit about the data that underlies that approval and also what your thoughts about it are in terms of using it in clinical practice?
So funny you should mention that. I tried to utilize it about a week ago, but not with a cisplatin backbone. I was treating with gemcitabine carboplatin, and the FDA indication is with cisplatin, so it was denied. And the patient couldn't take cisplatin, so we didn't utilize it. I mean, I think it offers a modest benefit, but non-small cell lung cancer needs whatever modest benefit we can get. So I think it's a reasonable option for patients. It does enhance toxicity in terms of some of the neutropenia, but on the whole, I think it's a reasonable addition in the appropriate patient.
What was the patient situation where you wanted to use it? And, you know, sometimes people talk about younger patients, people who are more motivated, who want every possible advantage. Was that the situation or something else?
No, it was a younger patient who we thought that we discussed the options with the patient, and it's a little more involved for the patient in terms of a number of times they come in. But it was something we discussed, they were interested in, and then they had insurance issues vis-a-vis that particular drug.
Interesting. Have you used the drug, and any thoughts or information about dermatologic toxicity?
You know, I've used it infrequently at best, and I haven't seen much in the way of skin toxicity. Those are class effects with EGFR monoclonal antibodies. We saw that with cetuximab, but it hasn't been an issue for us yet.
Another issue here in this patient who's currently on a PD-1 antibody is what are you going to do if the patient, like most people, actually have disease progression, unfortunately. Hopefully he won't fit into that category. But if he were to develop disease progression and, you know, for example, found on imaging, but he was still stable clinically, what would you be thinking about third line therapy? And what kinds of trial options, you know, might you be thinking about?
So if I was in practice without a clinical trial option, given that he'd had paclitaxel, carboplatin, and now nivolumab, the options available would include docetaxel with or without the addition of ramucirumab, and then there's gemcitabine and vinorelbine. So those would be the choices off study, I think, available to him.
I guess another issue, you mentioned the potential outside of trial setting of using ramucirumab, another anti-angiogenic, obviously approved and utilized a lot in gastric cancer. What's your thinking? Are you generally offering it to patients in this situation? Are you recommending it?
So it is approved in squamous cell carcinoma of the lung, and so that's a discussion point that we have. And then I'm very cognizant of discussing the pros and cons of the therapy with the patients. Now, with ramucirumab, in addition to docetaxel, you saw about a 5 to 6 week improvement in overall survival, which again, modest, but it's an improvement, and some patients do better than that. And the nice thing about these regimens is we can always stop something if a patient runs into toxicity.
Another thing that's going on in squamous cell, and really, I mean, the way I saw this thing evolve, it really came out of what happened at MD Anderson with the battle studies that were done, is the so-called master protocol in squamous cell. Can you talk a little bit about that and where things are with that study?
So the master protocol is a national effort. It's a cooperative group trial incorporating many sites, which is trying to identify activating mutations for which we have compounds. So patients will have their tumor profiled. And then for those patients for whom we have a therapy, whether it's PI3 or FGFR or CDK, they're randomized to that arm for therapy. For those patients who don't have an activating mutation or a druggable mutation, or we don't have a therapy for that particular mutation, they receive immunotherapy.
Yeah, I thought that was a really, you know, attractive part of the study, because the last I saw it was, I think it was PD-1 versus PD-1 anti-CTLA-4, which I don't think you could get that outside a trial setting.
No, I don't think you can right now. So it's a good option for folks.
And the other thing that I was seeing on that study that I thought was interesting is I think right now there are 3 targetable mutations they have with drugs, and they're finding a fair number of people who have it. So at least it seems like it's kind of working. And as I mentioned, I don't know to what extent you were involved with the battle studies, but to me, that was really the first time that people tried to access tissue specifically to try to target therapy. How do patients respond to this kind of concept?
Well, actually, I did participate in the battle trial, ran one of the arms, and you're exactly right. This study established that you could, in a metastatic setting, go back and get additional tissue and do the profiling, try and identify the best therapy for patients. And this was an early effort. This is before we knew about EGFR mutations or ALK translocations. And so we had a series of algorithms that we looked through in terms of what was expressed, trying to determine which of the four treatment arms a patient was assigned to. But I can tell you the patients were excited to try something different. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for chemotherapy, although it does work. But patients come looking for something else, and it inherently makes sense to try and do personalized medicine. So I think it's something that definitely captured the patient's imagination. So we didn't have issues with patients wanting to get involved or getting the biopsies.
You know, the other thing that sort of ties into this is the question of tissue testing, particularly in squamous cell. I'll ask you about non-squamous, a totally different arena. But in terms of tissue testing here, obviously, it's second line. They're testing for clinical trials. But another issue that comes up in a lot of cancers is the patient who's already received all the approved forms of therapy. They've kind of run out of options, but they're still in good condition and they want to be treated. And whether it's a squamous cell of the lung or breast cancer, colon cancer, et cetera, people are sending multiplex testing, for example, next generation sequencing, and getting back data and then acting on it. Any thoughts about that phenomena? There's also serum assays looking, you know, for mutations. Any thoughts about where that's at right now?
I think the serum assays are exciting. So they're looking at circulating free DNA. And it's roughly about an 80% correlation with the tissue biopsy, and it's much faster. So we can literally draw blood, send it off, and have an answer within 2 weeks. Generally, in my practice, I'll send off the blood for molecular analysis and also order a biopsy to obtain that information. Because again, it's an 80% correlation, not 100%. But for example, I've identified patients with T790M that way.
What about people with squamous though? Is it really worth doing?
Well, I think we're looking, and we've actually found, and there are anecdotal reports of this as well, that some patients have a mixed histology or will actually have an EGFR mutation, although I've not seen it. There have been reports in the literature of patients having EGFR mutation, although they have a squamous cell cancer. So I think there are probably mixed histologies out there that just weren't captured. So I think it's a reasonable thing to do. But you're right, we don't have an established biomarker that requires tissue testing in order to get a therapy. But I think in order to make that door open to patients, I think testing now is the way to go as these new studies are coming along and these new drugs are coming along. I do think with the positive data in the frontline setting with single agent PD-L1 in a heavy expressing patient population, that greater than 50% of cells have expression, that that's going to lead to more testing, not just in the non-squamous, but also in the squamous.
And I'm curious, what kind of gets you to think more about being aggressive about testing when you have a, quote, squamous cell patient? You mentioned the issue of sampling, the fact that, you know, you do one biopsy. Is that really representative? Also, the issue of sort of mixed adeno-squamous. Do you ever see non-smokers who are labeled as squamous?
I haven't seen that, but I've seen small cell lung cancer patients who are non-smokers. I've had colleagues who have seen squamous cell patients who are non-smokers. I think it's something we need to do to give, you know, I think the more information you gather, the better decisions you can make for patients. And as we get that genetic information, it may correlate or dovetail with the clinical trial that's opening. Right now, in terms of general practice, aside from looking at PD-L1 to use these drugs in the frontline setting, there's not an approved therapy that requires that testing. But I think as we're developing new compounds, a good example is a DLL3, starting to test in other tumor types where it makes sense is really the way we should be going.
Let's talk a little bit about non-squamous cancers in terms of management in the metastatic setting, particularly in terms of tissue testing and management of patients with genomic alterations. First, when you evaluate a patient or when a general oncologist evaluates a patient who has a non-squamous tumor, metastatic disease, what would be your recommendation to a community-based oncologist about what to do in terms of sort of one-off testing for EGFR, ALK, or ROS1, for example, versus multiplex testing for example, NGS? And would your recommendations change whether the patient's a smoker or non-smoker?
So in general, when I see patients, it depends on how much tissue they have. And I do have a hierarchy, an algorithm that I like to go through. Generally, we'll test in our MDL about 50 different genes. But in terms of what will come first, if there's a paucity of tissue, I look at ALK and ROS1. because that's the only way to get those drugs. You have to be positive. Then EGFR after that. But I think all things being equal, a test for the usual 50-gene panel. We like to get core biopsy so we have adequate tissue. And again, we talked about the circulating free DNA that we also send off. But if a patient comes to see me, they're doing well, we'll talk about getting molecular profiling. And it's going to depend on where they are in terms of their symptoms and their level of anxiety with their diagnosis. Some patients want to wait to find out what the molecular profiling is. And if they look clinically like that's an appropriate thing, then we'll do so. It usually takes about a month to get all that information back. And then if we have something, we start to treat them with, say, an EGFR inhibitor if they're an EGFR mutation positive patient. For those patients who are symptomatic from their disease, I'll still send those things off for analysis, but I'll go ahead and initiate chemotherapy. And if something is positive later on, then I know I can utilize that as a second line option.
Again, for an oncologist in general practice, from your point of view, in a patient, again, with metastatic non-squamous cancer who does not have EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, do you think that they should routinely have some type of multiplex testing sent?
I think patients should do both serum and, if tissue's available, do NGS. Realizing that in a community practice, if they're ROS1 negative, ALK negative, and EGFR negative, they're not other approved drugs or other targets, but we're getting data now with RET, and there's data coming out for BRAF. So identifying those, I think, are important.
As I mentioned, I talked to Tony Mauch also for this program. We talked a lot about targeted therapy, but there were a few things we didn't talk about that I wanted to ask you about in terms of that. One is something that kind of just came on my radar recently, which is we were talking about checkpoint inhibitors. And I guess I was wondering where things stand from your point of view with the use of checkpoint inhibitors in people with targetable mutations. There's been discussion that, you know, maybe these people don't respond as well, less PD-1, they're non-smokers. Does that change your algorithm? You were talking about kind of a standard second-line approach. What about in patients with targetable mutations?
So we're actually doing a study right now where we're looking at the combination of an EGFR inhibitor plus a PD-1 inhibitor. But to get to your point, the data sets that have come out from a number of trials demonstrate that patients who have higher mutational burden, generally smokers, have a higher response rate. I think it's about 25% if there's a higher mutational burden. And then those that don't, the response rates are lower, and they're lower than the usual 18%. So there is a correlation with higher genetic mutational load, et cetera, and benefit when you treat it with a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. You know, in routine practice, no. If someone has an EGFR mutation or an ALK translocation, I'll treat them with the appropriate compound or compounds depending on how their tumor progresses and their treatment progresses. I'm not using those combinations off study. I do think that immunotherapy is a reasonable option for those patients at progression if there's not a third generation EGFR TKI that's available for them or if they've run through the gamut of ALK inhibitors.
So just to run through this in terms of EGFR, for example, So if you have a patient who starts out on an EGFR TKI, afatinib or erlotinib, usually in this country, responds and then has disease progression. First of all, how do you approach the issue of testing for T790? Do you get serum? Do you get tissue, urine?
So I do serum and tissue because the serum comes back a little sooner. And I've identified a number of patients that way who had T790M. And in general, if there's diffuse progression, T790M positive will transition from their EGFR, first generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor over to osimertinib, and they'll take that. But as we mentioned earlier, there's tumor heterogeneity. And so I've had patients who had one spot that grew and everything else was controlled. And these are patients who've been on erlotinib for some years. And we biopsied that particular patient, and sure enough, it was a T790M mutation in that particular area that was growing. But all the other sites of disease, which were numerous, were controlled. So we ended up irradiating that one spot, and then we're holding osimertinib on the back burner in the event that other sites of disease become resistant.
Interesting. You said you did serum and tissue. What about urine? Again, Heather Wakely at ASCO presented just a few cases, but it looked pretty interesting.
It did look interesting, but no, that's not a common practice for us.
And in terms of T790 negative patients, which I guess is around half or less of those patients, what are the options you think through?
It depends on if we find something that's targetable, do they have a MET alteration that we can proceed with? It's roughly 60% that are T790M, and then that other 40% it can be MET. That's one that comes to mind. Other mutations can occur, but if they don't have something that we have a drug for or a clinical trial for, then I think it's appropriate at that point to initiate chemotherapy if they haven't had chemotherapy yet. Immunotherapy depends on where they are in their treatment cycle.
But again, if all they've had was one TKI, now they have disease progression, would they be more likely to get chemo or a checkpoint inhibitor?
If they've had one TKI and they have disease progression, I'm inclined to give them chemotherapy and then utilize the checkpoint inhibitor later.
I've heard people talk about looking at PD-1 levels in that situation, people who don't look at it, you know, up front in the typical situation. What about that thinking? And in general, are you looking at PD-1 levels at all in your decision-making?
So we're starting to do that. And when you asked me that question, I was assuming that we would be testing for that as well as a part of it. Clearly, if someone's a high overexpressor for PD-L1, then it makes sense to give them an inhibitor of PD-L1 or a PD-1 inhibitor. But I still think even those patients who are PD-L1 negative, clearly looking at the phase 3 data, they are at least in terms of single agent chemotherapy have equivalent outcomes and less toxicity. So I think it's a reasonable thing to do in that population. In the refractory setting, I'm not routinely testing. In the frontline setting, we're starting to test.
You mentioned osimertinib, which is now utilized in T790 positive disease. What have you observed in terms of tolerability issues?
It's been a little bit wide. So osimertinib, as you know, is approved for this particular patient population, 80 milligrams daily. And one of the unique aspects of this is you have to get an echocardiogram every 3 months just to make sure there's no effect on the cardiac function. I've had some patients who sailed through with this and actually are doing quite well. But I have one patient who's been on since June, and she developed grade 3 neutropenia, which happens in about 3% of the patients. And for that particular patient, we held the dose for several weeks. She had some recovery over counts, and then we've just resumed it at 40 milligrams daily. And she's tolerating treatment better. Her counts are staying where they need to stay. And importantly, her cancer has not progressed.
Interesting. You had this patient you brought in today, this 70-year-old man who kind of, again, went through a typical thing, got erlotinib. Looks like here you found the T790 in the serum and on repeat biopsy, if I'm reading this right, and is now on osimertinib. First, is that correct up to this point?
Exactly. So I sent off the serum, but again, because the serum's not 100%, and if it's negative, I still want tissue. We went ahead and got a biopsy as well. And the serum came back positive several weeks later. And so we brought him back in to initiate treatment. And then he had confirmatory findings on his biopsy.
Where was the biopsy done?
He had a biopsy of his liver.
And I'm curious about what happened to the tumor.
Well, he's actually responded. He's doing quite well. He's had a good, robust response, as he did initially with his first-generation EGFR TKI, and he's doing well with this now.
The thing that interested me, because I'm still trying to kind of figure this out, is you say he's had problems with a skin rash. What happened there?
Well, his skin rash, he's had some waxing and waning rash, and these third-generation drugs don't have the same degree of rash, regeneration of rash, as you do see with the first-generation drugs. And he had a much more robust rash with his first-generation EGFR TKI. He's getting some dry skin and occasional pimples, but nothing compared to what he had before. And so overall, he feels better. He's not having any GI complaints either.
That's interesting. So he actually, in a way, I guess his rash got better. In other words, he had a bad rash under erlotinib. Essentially, he kind of got better.
Correct.
I've always been fascinated by the idea of adjuvant targeted therapy. And of course, we're still trying to figure that out. But when I first heard about these third generation agents, my first thought was it may be a lot easier to get in, you know, long term, couple years, whatever it's going to be with them compared to some of the first generation agents.
You know, I think these drugs in the right populations are well tolerated. There are some other nuances. For example, with the first generation drugs, we don't have to worry about cardiac function. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody have myelosuppression, but these drugs do work well in the right patient population. Now, in terms of adjuvant treatment, there are a number of studies right now looking at adjuvant therapy with the appropriate TKI or with immunotherapy. And they're trying to answer that question. Because again, those, as we mentioned earlier, those questions take years to get addressed.
So there was another third generation agent, rosalitinib, that was out there for a while. And that seems like it hit the dust, so to speak, for toxicity issues, lack of efficacy, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it looks like there are a couple others coming along. I was curious about if they pose any potential advantage. One, BI-1482-694, which I heard maybe is not even going to be developed. But then another one, ASP-8273. Any thoughts about them?
So they're third-generation drugs. The olmutinib study was done, in Korea only, and the patients were T790M positive. And it had a similar response rate to osimertinib, around 60% in that patient population, and had a duration of response of roughly 8 to 9 months. And it had the typical side effects of diarrhea, rash. I'm not sure where they're going to go with this, because you're right, that's going to be a hard space for another drug to break into without being markedly different or showing activity perhaps in osimertinib refractory patients. I do think they're doing a phase 2 study, actually they completed it, Alexa-1, where they were looking at this particular compound, and they're looking at some other combinations or comparators in this population with this compound. But you're right, I think it's going to be a difficult space to step into. A, you've got to get the activity, and B, you've got to have a reasonable toxicity profile that's going to make a rationale for wanting to try the drug.
What about this agent ASP8273?
Well, we don't have a lot of data on that. I think roughly 50-odd patients were treated on that particular study. It's a phase 1 study. There was a disease control rate of around 60%, but the response rate was more in the 30 to 40% range, which wasn't as robust as we saw with osimertinib or with the olmutinib. I think that was one of the problems, in addition to having some toxicity regards hyperglycemia, the response rates, they didn't hold up, and they came down into the 30s.
So I want to go back and talk a little bit more about immunotherapy. And to do this, you had a case that I thought was really interesting. It was really amazing, actually. And it looks kind of complicated, but maybe you can sort of talk about the basics of it. This 53-year-old lady with the brain mets, what a really amazing story. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Certainly. So about 3 years ago, she presented with symptoms secondary to brain metastasis, and she was found to have an adenocarcinoma that was KRAS mutation positive. And her brain metastasis was treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. And then she received chemotherapy with carboplatin pemetrexed, and then docetaxel. And eventually she enrolled on a clinical trial with a PD-L1 monoclonal antibody and took roughly 19 cycles of treatment. So she was on that for a good long while, had a great response. It was a durable response.
So she actually had an objective response?
Yeah, she had a RECIST criteria response. She had a good response.
Where was the disease, and how long did it take the response to occur?
Outside of the brain, she had disease in her lung and in her liver. And it took roughly, I think within the first 2 cycles of treatment, she was beginning to respond. And I've noticed with this class of agents that patients, if they're going to respond, tend to respond within the first scan.
Any tolerability issues with her?
No, she didn't. We've had some patients that develop colitis, rare cases of pneumonitis, even thyroiditis, but she didn't have any issues vis-a-vis that. She did well, as I said, for 19 cycles. And then I think the interesting part is after she progressed, she got additional chemotherapy, and then we sat down and talked about options, and we went ahead and rechallenged her with nivolumab, and she's now in her 15th cycle, I think, of nivolumab.
And that's what really struck me about this case. The retreatment, did she have an objective response?
She didn't have a PR, but she definitely had a decrease in her disease burden. And more importantly, from my standpoint, is her disease has remained stable after presenting with additional progression. And it speaks to, we're not really clear how to utilize these drugs. What's the duration of treatment? Do you get T-cell fatigue from continuous exposure? Those things are all being investigated in the subsequent series of studies, like what's the duration of therapy? Do you need treatment breaks and then rechallenge? And this is just an empiric case of someone who got additional treatment after progressing on a checkpoint inhibitor and has now benefited from additional checkpoint exposure.
You mentioned earlier something that I've been interested in. I've been asking people a lot of different tumor backgrounds about, which is the issue of using checkpoint inhibitors in patients with prior autoimmune disease. We're just now starting to see a little bit of data coming out on that. Most of these patients were not able to go in the trial, so we really don't know much about it. What's your take right now on the risk of using checkpoint inhibitors in people with different autoimmune disease, and have you had to deal with it, and how would you deal with it?
Well, actually, I'm dealing with it right now. So my general approach has been not to enroll anybody who has an autoimmune illness. But as you mentioned, we're starting to see some laxing of those rules. And we're looking at patients and making determinations, you know, do they have to be on therapy for their autoimmune illness? Are they having symptoms from it? How severe is it? Those things are all getting factored in there. But in general, if someone has an autoimmune illness, I don't offer them immunotherapy. I think the risk-benefit ratio is not there yet.
I guess the argument's made, you know, you get out second, third line therapy of non-small cell, you're looking at, you know, very, very grim prognosis, you know, quote, what do you have to lose?
And that's one way of looking at it. But again, with the immunotherapy in an unselected patient population, we're seeing responses on the order of about 18%. So the majority of people don't respond. And when people have a bad autoimmune response, get a bad colitis or a pneumonitis, it can be devastating and sometimes fatal.
So I want to finish out talking a little bit about people with ALK translocations. And I see you have a patient here, a 45-year-old man. Can you talk a little bit about him?
So this is a gentleman who, again, presented with a brain metastasis. And during the course of his evaluation and treatment for his brain metastasis, was found to have non-small cell lung cancer, and it was ALK positive. And we placed him on crizotinib just over a year ago, and he's responded. He's doing well. And he's having nominal symptoms from his treatment and is actually living a very full life. And of the patients that I'm treating right now with ALK inhibitors, I've got a number of patients who are 3 years and 4 years on crizotinib, which I know is outside the bandwidth of what we consider the usual progression-free intervals. But in the event that he does develop progression of disease, there are a number of options now, ceritinib, alectinib, which are now approved. So he has a number of choices. But as long as he's doing well, we're going to continue with what we're on. Now, the other thing is, and this has been something that's been documented, that patients with ALK translocation have higher rates of brain metastasis, approaching 40, 50, even 60%. And that's likely a reflection of the fact that crizotinib doesn't penetrate the blood-brain barrier as well. And patients are staying on therapy for long periods of time, allowing these metastases to develop. The nice thing about the subsequent generations of drugs, ceritinib and alectinib, is that they both penetrate the blood-brain barrier and can treat brain metastasis.
And finally, I'm curious about your thoughts about the study, the J. Alex trial, the first-line study presented at ASCO, comparing alectinib to crizotinib.
So that was exciting data. I think we need data that's in a more of a Western European population to make that assessment, though. It's certainly promising. It looks like a more potent drug. And the question that's going to come up is what's the best way to sequence these drugs? The second and third generation drugs work on the mutations of resistance that patients get crizotinib develop. So the question will be, is it better to give, say, alectinib up front, and then what are you going to do subsequent therapies? Or is it better to go with crizotinib up front, and then you have a clear path of multiple therapies and sequential treatment? Where do you get the most mileage for the patients?
Subsequent to these interviews, on October 24, 2016, the FDA granted approval to pembrolizumab for the first-line treatment of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer whose tumors express PD-L1 as determined by an FDA-approved test. This concludes our program. And if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our faculty, please email me your case at drneillove@researchtopractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.